He was named America's Best Theologian by Time magazine, but he's proof that the last can be first. Stanley Hauerwas was a bricklayer like his father before he became a theologian. He joins me today, as does another theologian and political scientist, the Pakistani Muslim academic Asma Barlas. Both live and work in the U.S., and they're on The Spirit of Things right here with me, Rachel Kahn, on RN at abc.net.au/radionational. As part of the Wheeler Center's lecture series on faith and culture held recently in Melbourne, both Stanley Hauerwas and Asma Barlas engaged concepts of the West, and particularly Christianity. Hauerwas is a theologian who's both popular yet anti-liberal, which doesn't mean he's right-wing politically. He's for a strong countercultural position, including pacifism, which he believes true Christianity requires. Asma Barlas, on the other hand, is critical of the Christian West for different reasons. She takes a Muslim perspective and pronounces the West guilty of crusader consciousness. It's not an entirely one-sided argument, as she also accuses Muslim civilization of failing to live up to its true calling. So, both of my guests today are not happy, and we find out what that means for them, starting with the man who sees his work as post-liberal theology. Stanley Hauerwas, it's great to have you on The Spirit of Things.
It's great to be here.
Well, in your talk to the Wheeler Center, you wondered aloud why atheists are so busy trying to show that Christianity is false, when in today's liberal societies, it's treated as just another lifestyle choice. Do you think the church has come to see itself that way?
Yes, and that's my main message, is that the problem that we face today is Christianity's unwillingness to take itself seriously.
Has this been a strategy for survival, or has it just been a consequence of people choosing not to be Christian, and therefore by default Christianity is sort of one choice among many in an open, secularized society?
I think it's the Christian attempt to still give itself the illusion it's in control, that if it can show that what Christians believe is the reigning ideology necessary to run liberal societies, and what that ideology is doesn't necessarily require that Jesus was raised from the dead, then as a matter of fact, we Christians can give ourselves the illusion that this is still more or less a Christian social order.
What sort of signs do Christians send themselves that make them think they're still in power?
They more or less assume that they need to say something like, Jesus Christ is Lord, but it's just my personal opinion. So that way of expressing their faith gives the sense that we're good liberal citizens, having disciplined our lives to make sure we don't say anything offensive, in a manner that you can recognize that we are first and foremost tolerant people. And tolerant people, of course, are people that always assume they're in power. Who wants really to be tolerated? So Christians underwrite, it seems to me, the largely sentimental presuppositions of the social world in which they find themselves in a way that results in making unintelligible what Christians have fundamentally thought about the world in the past.
So your main point is that the church offers an alternative politics to worldly politics. That's what you say in your lecture. But right. Given we mean very specific structures and processes by the term politics, what do you mean by Christian politics?
I never use that phrase, Christian politics. What I would say is that the church, if it is appropriately disciplined, will provide a paradigm of a political alternative to the world's politics just to the extent that the church's politics is shaped by a commitment to live peaceably in a world of violence. So if you just take the fundamental position that Christians are called to live nonviolently in a world of war, not because we believe that nonviolence is a strategy to end war, though we will do what we can, but rather as faithful followers of Christ in a world of war, we cannot imagine being anything other than nonviolent. Now, that is an alternative that should challenge the presumption that violence is inevitable. So a community that is committed to nonviolence, of course, is a community that is going to be extraordinarily conflictual, because what you cannot stand in such a community is for the truth not to be spoken. And for the truth to be spoken means you must be ready to challenge one another. So I would like to think that the kind of conflictual politics that should constitute Christian communities is an alternative to what is the politics of the world in which people simply shout at one another rather than argue.
So are you a pacifist then?
I am. I am a pacifist. I don't like the language at all. Because it just sounds so passive. And I don't like the language of nonviolence, because who wants to represent a position that depends upon not being something? I assume that the gestures toward the description of pacifism or nonviolence is just a shorthand way of saying what it means to be a disciple of Christ.
But if you're uncomfortable with the term pacifism and nonviolence, aren't you exhibiting the very same characteristics you revile in liberals today who can't stand up and say what they believe?
Well, I'm more than ready to say that I'm a pacifist and I'm committed to nonviolence. I just then have to say something else in order to make sure that those terms do not become self-explanatory in a way that leaves out the theological presuppositions that make them intelligible.
Just one thing. Did I hear you say that proclaiming yourself as a pacifist can end up creating conflict and maybe even some violence in society?
I certainly think it does necessarily create conflict within a community. Our violences often lie in assumed agreements that are the result of coercive, manipulative human relations. So one of the things that, if you're committed to nonviolence, is the willingness to expose the violence that is in order that people presume is peace. So Christian nonviolence is going to exhibit itself as quite conflictual, just to the extent it's ready to challenge the violences that lay in our orders.
Mm. Well, you've been attracted to the theology of the Swiss-born German Karl Barth, the towering Protestant theologian of the first half of the 20th century, who believed passionately in a God who was wholly other, who breaks upon us from above, and can be known only and unless God first makes himself known to us. Now, can you explain how significant was that view over and against the liberal trends of theology?
It was a fundamental challenge to the attempt to make Protestant theology intelligible as a form of anthropology. That is, that what most Christian doctrines did from the Protestant liberal point of view was to talk about the human, in Barth's phrase, in a very loud voice, and confuse that loud voice with talking about God. Barth's God is God was a fundamental challenge to that liberal attempt to show that Christian theology was but a disguised form of humanism.
So was he countering the view that God speaks through man, which could give rise to the self-proclaimed messianic figures, such as Hitler, who was in Barth's midst?
He certainly did that, but he did it by saying, God does not speak through man. God spoke through a man who happened to be a Jewish man. And therefore, Barth caught on very early to the idolatrous character of the Nazis.
Yes, I think Barth would express this as God exists, speaks, and acts as the partner of man, the absolute superior partner.
Right. That's for Barth, the otherness of God is to be found in God's absolute nearness to us by becoming a man. And what that does is fundamentally challenge the presumption that we can make God in our own image, because God's image is the image of crucifixion.
So the idea of trying to make God in one's own image leads then to an easy accommodation, would you say, of that Christian faith to the norms of the day, the values of the day?
It certainly worked out that way. And it's very hard to see that it wouldn't work out that way, given the fundamental methodological presuppositions behind Protestant liberalism. As exemplified in particular by a great German philosopher, theologian Ernst Troeltsch. I mean, once you no longer believe that God raised Jesus from the dead, then you want to make Christianity a part of the civilizational religion necessary to continue the Western project. That was Troeltsch all the way down, and that's what Barth fundamentally challenged.
Stanley Hauerwas commenting there on Karl Barth, the great Swiss-German Reformed theologian of the last century. Like Barth, Hauerwas rejects the too close connection that Christianity can have with national culture. This is The Spirit of Things on RN. I'm Rachel Kahn. Later, Asma Barlas will tell us why she thinks the West hasn't come to grips with Islam. But now, back to Stanley Hauerwas and my question about the actual link between Karl Barth, who refused to swear allegiance to Hitler, and his own views of his church today. Karl Barth was critical of the modern church of his day, which I think he saw as morphing from a popular pietism into a nationalism. And of course, that would be Hitler's brand of nationalism. A disaster. So do you see it in the current state of the church?
Yes, I'm an American. I mean, there is no church more nationalistic than the American church. You can see that clearly in the response to September the 11th, when George Bush gave the American people the gift, we are at war. There were very, very few American Christians saying that we is not us. So one of the fundamental challenges is how to separate the Christian we from the American we.
I'm confused here because you're talking about the American church, and yet when one thinks of the tapestry of American Christianity, everything from evangelical Lutheranism, the Roman Catholic Church, conservative to liberal, the Episcopal Church, Baptists, Churches of Christ. Do you see those as all being of one mind?
As Archbishop George of Chicago often observes, Catholicism in America has really become a form of Protestantism, exactly to the extent that Catholics in America now think that being Catholic is their personal choice. And on the whole, the kinds of Protestant denominations you enumerate are very much the same. Just they will appear different or emphasize some part of their tradition as different in order to get their market shares of a shrinking market. But on the whole, there's no great difference in mainstream Protestantism. Evangelical Protestantism that's identified with the Christian right in America is a desperate attempt to try to recapture some more authentic aspect of Christianity. But the problem is they don't know dip about Christianity. So the way that they express themselves turns out to be more right-wing than Christian.
So on the one hand, there is the hegemonic American church, in quotes, but on the other hand, you seem to say that there is also a dissipation, a removal of Christian consciousness from the world, from America, and the result is a nihilism, made worse by the fact that Christianity did once exist. Now, what do you mean by that? Is it an allusion to an apocalyptic outlook? That is, when you lose Christian faith, the rule of Satan comes in, the last judgment and the end of days?
I think once Christianity has established some of its fundamental presuppositions in a social order, and you lose the fundamental Christian convictions that made those practices intelligible, then a society, once it's no longer Christian, will have worse outcomes than if Christianity never existed. So one of the things that we're now experiencing is how Christianity supplies a narrative for a savior nation that displaces exactly what Christians should believe as a alternative to a savior nation.
Well, you end your talk with the observation that Christendom is ended, and that opens up an opportunity, indeed an imperative, for the church to be politic. How do you see that playing out? What would it look like?
I think it would look like something like this. I have a poster that shows two anguished people hugging one another that was developed by the Mennonite Central Committee, and it says on the poster, "A modest proposal for peace, let the Christians of the world resolve not to kill one another." Now, if we could just get to that point, that Christians discovered that they are just distinct enough not to kill one another, then I think we would be a people who would both be distrusted by the world and therefore need one another in a manner that would offer the world an alternative that otherwise cannot be seen. So I have a very modest project. I would just like to, in my life, to convince as many Christians as I can that Christians have a problem with war. Most Christians don't even have any idea that Christians have a problem with war. And so if we could get to that point, I think a great achievement would come from Christians recognizing that we're not like everybody else. We've got a problem with war.
Well, Stanley, let me take you back to your youth. You were raised, I think, as a Methodist, but that wasn't quite enough to convince you of the truth of Christianity. So you studied philosophy and then went to Yale Divinity School and emerged a theologian. How much space is there in our culture, even in the church, for theologians, when the whole phenomenon of Twitter, for example, you know, assumes that anything worthwhile can be reduced to 140 characters?
It's obviously a challenge. Theologians are workers with words, and that's hard work. I was raised a bricklayer, And I would like to think that working with words has the same kind of skills that laying brick require, namely, you got to do it one brick at a time in a way that one brick is related to another brick in a way that the head joints are true. And that theology is a slow and painful work that must proceed in that manner, whether people want to support it or not. One of the great problems with so much of contemporary theology is theologians, because they're academics, write primarily for other theologians. Exactly, one of our challenges is to write theology in a manner that the audience that is designed for can read it, and that's, they're called Christians. Exactly, that's a great advantage for theologians, because even though we are primarily academics today, we have a people to write for. They're obligated to read us. They're Christians, and that means that I don't despair of the work of theology, exactly because there are a readership that is not just sequestered in the university.
Well, Time magazine nominated you as America's best theologian. So what does that mean?
It was the best theologian in America.
In America. Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, the qualifier wasn't American. And I take that to be important. When they came to tell me that this had happened, the publicist that had came to tell me, a lovely man named Reed, my first response, of course, I just thought it was absurd, was best is not a theological category. And I really mean that. I think that I always say the secular always finds a way to humiliate you. That was my form of humiliation. But that's all right, because without humiliation, probably none of us would know what humility might be. So I thought it was a good lesson for me.
Well, I think you're probably a terrific tweeter, because even that comment you just made, you've issued some very good quotes. May I read a couple of them?
Surely.
The courageous have fears that cowards never know. That's a great one. And never think you need to protect God. You can be sure that if you think you need to protect God, you're worshiping an idol. Now, those probably both fit on Twitter.
Well, I don't Twitter. My highest technological achievement is a cell phone. It's not an iPhone. And I use my computer primarily to write. And so I'm not technologically proficient in these matters. And I don't have any strong views about Twitter and that kind of thing, because I really don't even know what the phenomenon is.
Well, I won't bother trying to introduce you to it here. You mention in an article about your recent memoir, Hannah's Child, that theologians don't usually write memoirs. Has writing your memoir contributed to your theology?
I hope that the memoir exhibits many of the theological lessons I've learned. Writing a memoir is an invitation to narcissism, and it turned out I'm just narcissistic enough to give in to the temptation. But what I wanted to try to do was exhibit how, for me to be a Christian, it means that I have been befriended by people who have made me vulnerable in a way to that description. And I think that's the way it's supposed to work. So my memoir is what I hope is an ongoing narrative that's a witness to the significance of friendship.
So being a Christian is not just proclaiming your faith, it's being recognized as one.
Yes, and that's very difficult.
Well, I think you have been, at least by Time magazine. Stanley Hauerwas, it's been great having you on The Spirit of Things. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's good to be here. Thank you.
Stanley Hauerwas is the Gilbert T. Rowe Professor of Theological Ethics at Duke University. On The Spirit of Things on RN, we're getting a taste of some of the leading lights in theology in the public square. Take a look at our website for further details and links, and to download the audio. If something tweaked your interest, then tweet at Spirit of Things and share your insight. Here's Sinead O'Connor from her recent album, Theology.
By the rivers of Babylon, where I sat down, there I wept when I remembered Zion. By the rivers of Babylon, where I sat down, because my tormentors required songs, songs of where I'm from, songs of where I'm from. Oh, songs of Zion.
This crusade, this war on terrorism, is going to take a while. But I can assure the American people, I will keep my focus to make sure that not only are these brought to justice, but anybody who's been associated will be brought to justice.
President George W. Bush, 5 days after September 11th, 2001. Was that a momentary use of rhetoric? Or a deep-seated antipathy that lies latent and ready to pounce? We've heard what a Christian theologian has to say about how he'd like his faith expressed. Now we'll hear from a Muslim academic, Asma Barlas, who is director for the Center of Race, Culture, and Ethnicity at Ithaca College, New York, was invited to the Wheeler Center in Melbourne. Here I ask her about the talk she gave on the way the West thinks about Muslims. Asma Barlas, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you so much.
Well, in your talk for the Wheeler Center in Melbourne, you mm-hmm. were examining contemporary relations between Muslims and Christians. Why do you think it's important to view that relationship through a veil of past history?
Well, I think there's a historical amnesia in something that I call the West, understanding fully well that it isn't homogenous and it isn't unitary. But there is something that we can discern as Western discourse over a very long period of time. And I wanted to put many of these contemporary debates on immigration, national belonging, citizenship, multiculturalism in a longer historical perspective so as to provide a broader context for people to understand that many of these ideas that we think about as particularly new are actually reformulations of very old ways of thinking about and speaking about Islam and Muslims.
Well, let me take an example of bad relations between Muslims and Christians that you cite when a Danish newspaper published cartoons in which Muhammad was sent up with a bomb in his turban. That was in 2006. Mm-hmm. I saw that as when those cartoons were finally circulated, because very quickly they were not, and then later on people saw them. But when I did, I saw that as Europeans reacting to the incidents of suicide bombings and also the murder of Theo van Gogh in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
But you saw it as a holdover from negative depictions of Muslims in medieval times when Christian Europe was fighting the Moors and the Saracens.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that a bit of a longbow?
It could possibly be, but should we have anything against longbows? I would say that the figure of the terrorist, the way I see it, particularly as it's mapped onto the Prophet of Islam, is a kind of a secularization of his depiction as the Antichrist. Because in both roles, in one in a very much a Christian lexicon, and the other in a contemporary political and secular context, in both of those roles, the Prophet essentially is positioned in the same way ideologically vis-a-vis Westerners. So for me, it's fascinating to see how this depiction of Islam and of the Prophet as inherently anti-West or anti-Christian or as the antithesis of everything that people think of as reasonable or logical or good or pure, that the function, the ideological function of this image has remained essentially the same over centuries. And simply sort of seeing the cartoons as without this kind of genealogy as popping up out of more or less just contemporary consciousness is to ignore what Edward Said once referred to as latent Orientalism. In other words, something in our collective subconscious or unconscious, which can be tapped into very easily through certain images.
Well, if we are going to go to the past, you say the West has suffered from an odious view of Islam as the enemy of faith or the enemy of Christian Europe. Now, I just wonder if we're looking at the past, is that any different from the way, say, the Ottoman Empire viewed the Christians when it vanquished Byzantium and rededicated Sancta Sophia as a mosque? I mean, there are mutual antipathies here, are there not?
Of course, there are mutual antipathies. And the point, though, is that one of the tendencies, especially after 9/11/2001, is to focus almost exclusively on the trope, the reality, the symbolism of Muslim violence. And what I'm trying to do in my talk isn't to deny that Muslims also have a history of violence or that Islam sanctions certain kinds of violence. What I'm trying to do is rupture the silence that exists, it seems to me, at least in mainstream discourses, including in the media, about Western violence and its equally long history, if not, I would say, even a longer history of violence against Muslims. So, for instance, there's a wonderful little book by the historian Robert Southern, which is The Views of Islam in the Middle Ages or Medieval Christian Views of Islam. I've forgotten exactly the title. But even before Christians encountered Muslims as enemies, they already had a certain demonization of the religion and of the Saracens. So it's not even that this animosity or mutual antipathy arose because of actual physical battles between Muslims and Christians. So that's what fascinates me most of all, a construction of an enemy even prior to meeting them as the enemy.
So you don't see, for example, in America today, a groundswell or a discourse, no, I should say a discourse about the Crusades and Christians critiquing their own history of violence. You haven't picked up on that?
Have you? I mean, I'm curious because
yes.
I live in the U.S. and I mean, there are always critiques, and that's an important part of the conversation as well. But no, there hasn't been any groundswell. And you will remember probably that George W. Bush, the first words he used about 9/11/2001 was crusades. And much later, Oriana Fallaci, you know, when she's writing about Muslim immigration, is using the same tropes.
Yes, but George W. Bush and Oriana Fallaci have been regarded by a great middle ground of liberal critique as quite extreme. So they have come in for a lot of critique from the Christian establishment. I wouldn't say that, you know, they've been held up as paragons of what the West thinks, particularly in your circles, in academic circles.
No, they're not certainly held up as paragons of anything in particular. But my point rather is that they're able to tap into what I refer to as a sort of a latent subconsciousness or collective consciousness about Islam that stretches way back into time, so that it does, that language, that imagery does resonate with people.
Well, the Christian tradition hasn't come up very well, obviously, in your talk. But the secular West, particularly the Enlightenment, was no better in your view. And you cite Voltaire as a critic of the prophet, saying such views survive right up to the Danish cartoon scandal. Now, I just wonder how you can be so sure of that, given Voltaire also argued for the toleration of the Chinaman, the Jew, and the Turk in his treatise on toleration.
If I was writing specifically about Voltaire, I would be far more nuanced in what I have to say about him. I think the main point I'm trying to make is that in spite of toleration and in spite of certain changing images of Islam and Muslims over the centuries, because certainly these images haven't remained static, that in spite of all of that, there is this thread of condemnation which stretches over centuries altogether. I guess I'm fascinated by that discursive continuity.
Is there any alleviation to be found in another thread, which is very much evident in the 19th century, in which there were many romantic appreciations of Islam and Arabic culture, its poetry, its art, its mores? We think of T.E. Lawrence, Richard Burton, perhaps Thomas Carlyle. Have they left no positive legacy? For example, in our time, the tremendous interest in Jalaluddin Rumi in recent years?
That's a complicated question. I don't think my argument is that there haven't been any positive legacies. I think my argument rather is that these remain recessive, which isn't to deny that these tendencies exist. But why is it that they are not dominant in shaping discussions about Muslims in Europe today, for instance? Why is it that certain criminalizations, demonizations of Muslims continue to sort of pop up, whether it's in critiques of multiculturalism, whether it's in immigration or citizenship? I would also say that many of the positive images of Islam and Muslims partake of Orientalism, and I am well aware of the brief fashion in Europe of using Muslims as a modality for self-critique. But notwithstanding that, and notwithstanding individual relationships of solidarity and intellectuals who have been empathetic and sensitive and nuanced in their understanding of Islam and Muslims, I still insist on speaking about a collective historical approach to Islam and Muslims, which my bottom line is, precludes thinking about them in morally relevant ways, a phrase that I've borrowed from Richard Rorty.
Yes. Well, in your argument against the Danish cartoons, you say they aren't funny because most Westerners suspect Muslims of being terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just wondered if that's a bit of an exaggeration. I've seen the Pew Forum's research into views of Muslims, mm-hmm. and there is certainly a marked mistrust. But should we read that as terrorists? I mean, I don't encounter people, you know, daily who think that the Muslims around, say, Australia are terrorists. But do you think that's still very much in evidence? Do you see that?
Well, a couple of years ago, there was a poll, and my memory gets a bit worse every year. I think 44% of U.S. people wanted Muslims to carry ID cards. They didn't want Muslims as their neighbors. I personally travel out of a very small town in upstate New York, which is called Ithaca, and I think I've probably made 200 trips out of that, but I'm searched bodily every single time I take a flight. And one day I just did ask them. I said, you know, I travel out of here, maybe this last month I've taken 6 flights from here. What is it you're expecting to find? And they said, well, your name is on the list, and if you don't want us to do this, you need to write to the TSA and get your name off the list. Now, I don't want to generalize from my own personal experience, but it seems to me that if you're going to be anecdotal in terms of, you know, you don't run into people who think that, then I have to tell you, well, I run into people who do.
Dr. Asma Barlas is professor of politics at Ithaca College in New York. She began her career as a diplomat in Pakistan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and later worked as the assistant editor of an opposition paper, The Muslim, before leaving for the U.S. where she received political asylum. This is The Spirit of Things on RN at abc.net.au/radionational. And we are talking about the clash of Christian and Muslim cultures. The Pew Forum Research Center has examined public opinion on many areas on how Muslim and Western populations view each other. And one of the main areas of dispute was the low opinion Westerners had of Muslim treatment of women. And of course, it's also true that Muslim populations felt that Western attitudes towards women were not respectful. Asma, where does your opinion lie in this debate?
I think both of those things are true. I think that there are many, many Muslims who think that women in the West are utterly decadent and the source of moral corruption. There is a demonization of Western or Westernized women. And at the same time, obviously, we know that in the West, many people define their politics or political sensibilities, particularly white women who claim to be feminists, in terms of, you know, the position they take on saving Muslim women. And frequently, what bothers me about discussions along these lines is that, well, there's sexual violence against women in the United States. There's a rape every 14 seconds. And some of the same women who are very concerned about the violence that the Taliban are doing to women in Afghanistan, about which I'm terribly exercised as well, seem to ignore that there is a certain pervasive tendency in many cultures to be abusive to women and therefore exceptionalizing Muslim women as particularly victims is very offensive to me.
You've been a key critic of the patriarchal interpretations of the Quran. Would you say that Muslim-majority countries are captive to this patriarchal culture?
Yes. And I think patriarchy obviously predates Islam, and I think that one of the worst aspects of many Muslim cultures, even in spite of the enormous diversity in Muslim societies, is this belief in the ideology of male supremacy. And what I object to is reading that male supremacy into the Quran, which I've argued actually sort of presupposes a very debased view of God. If that part of my argument isn't clear, I should say that for Muslims, the Quran is the word of God, and the way the Quran describes God is that God is uncreated. God is not male, God is not female. And God is above sexual partisanship and sexual hatred. And when Muslims read sexual partisanship into the Quran or sexual hatred or discrimination or oppression into the Quran, in my view, they are also contributing to a derogation of a theologically sound conception of God.
What was your experience like in Pakistan? You've been in the U.S. for 30 years, as you mentioned, and I understand that your life was in danger for criticizing a military leader or ruler of Pakistan. Were you obliged to leave?
The first part of your question first. I come from a very privileged upper-class family in Pakistan, and I have not experienced the kind of sexual violence and discrimination that I saw a lot of women in Pakistan experience. So it's not just a sort of a personal vendetta, and I feel obliged to put it out there because of the tendency of many people to think that that's probably the only reason one can actually go out and critique violence against women, because one has been a victim oneself. Coming to the issue of whether my life was physically threatened, it was sufficiently uncomfortable after I was dismissed from the Foreign Service on the orders of General Ziaul Haq. Lots of things happened in the 1 year after that that made me want to leave. So I think that's the best way to put it. It's a long and painful and complicated story, and I have no good understanding of what might have happened to me had I continued to be in Pakistan. But that's also because of the ways in which political and personal factors in my life came together to create an environment that I didn't think was good, either for my son, who was 10 years old then, or for me.
Mm. You were given asylum in the U.S. Why did you choose political asylum in the West when you've been so critical of it?
Well, firstly, I didn't go to the U.S. with the idea of seeking asylum, because if I had, then I would have sought it much earlier. A number of things happened while I was in the U.S., including a conversation with a lawyer who was doing an asylum case for a friend of mine, which then eventually led me to claim it. But I do want to say that I have never maintained that there's a sort of homogenous West and all of it is bloody-minded or criminal. And I do see myself as the beneficiary of a U.S. legal system, because the judge who granted me asylum did so over the objections of the U.S. State Department, which insisted that there was no persecution of Zia's opponents in Pakistan when that was clearly not the case. So it's not as if every institution in the West is in cahoots with every other institution. So I do see myself as a beneficiary of that system. But let me also point out that the United States supported the military intervention of Zia-ul-Haq in politics. And sometimes my students are really mad at me. They say, why are you here? And I said, well, if you weren't there in my part of the world and you hadn't put dictators into power, I wouldn't have had to be here. But, this kind of influence travels in both directions.
Well, Asma, given what you have just said, and that is that the West is not homogeneous or hegemonic, is it really helpful to talk about the West in these terms as being kind of the enemy of Islam when indeed you've been given asylum and probably have many fellow travelers in the academic world who would argue critically about dimensions of Western culture or historical threads in it?
So one of the things that I just was trying to point to is that my own experience is pretty dual and fractured, that I am very much, I see myself very much as a victim of U.S. politics, but I see myself as a beneficiary of its legal system. So I wouldn't just simply reduce the complexity of that either to victimization or to being a beneficiary. I think I have to straddle the tensions there. Mm. Secondly, the West is not, it's a very inhospitable term in many ways, and it does a lot of epistemic violence as well, just as I don't want to have a homogenous, quote, Islam. I also dislike using the term the West many times, and in most of my talks, there is always a disclaimer. But the truth is that this is a self-naming on the part of Anglo-Europeans. They claim some identity that's called the West when it suits them. And so I want to take that seriously as well. And I want to point to dominant long-term historical tendencies and not my finger at every single person in the West, because after all, Muslims were in the West before the West was the West. I'm speaking of Muslims in Spain.
Mm.
So
you say in your article that the West should start thinking about difference in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder why you think the main work needs to be done in the West. Why not the Muslim majority cultures where difference can be punishable by death if you're a woman, a gay person, or simply a Christian passing out Bibles? Where is the work most urgent for acceptance of difference?
I don't think it's a zero-sum thing that either you can do one or you can do the other. And my work on the Quran, which challenges dominant patriarchal interpretations of it, is very much raising my voice against that view of difference in Muslim-majority countries, particularly as it's applied to women. So it depends on what it is that I'm talking about. At a conference on faith and culture that has to do with Muslims and some kind of history of Muslims in and with the West, then that's what I'm going to focus on. If you invite me to a conference where you ask me to talk about my work on the Quran, then you will hear something different. So I'm not here to say equal opportunity, you're criminal, and everyone's a criminal. Rather, it's an analysis of abuses of power. And if I'm speaking to Muslim audiences, or if I'm speaking about my work on the Quran to whatever audiences, what I emphasize is that aspect of violence against women. And if I'm speaking to a more general audience about Muslims in the West, then yes, I'm going to be absolutely focusing on Western violence towards Muslims. So it really does depend on the venue, the context, and the topic of conversation.
Well, Asma Barlas, where are we at? Will things get worse, in your view, before they get better? And what would better look like? I'm just wondering about whether you agree with Tariq Ramadan that Western civil society should reflect the ethics of all the religious traditions present in that society, and also allow Islam to sort of reshape Western ethics. Where do you fit in this kind of debate about the vision of an ideal future for Islam in the West?
I don't know about ideal futures, but I do agree with a lot of what Tariq Ramadan has to say about the relationship between Muslims living in the West and Muslims who are Westerners and non-Muslims in the West. And I don't know that I have a prognosis about whether things will get better or worse. The United States is at war in many countries where Muslims are a majority, including my country where I was born, Pakistan, where there are deaths every day through drones. So I don't know what it means for things to get worse before they get better. But I'm also one of those people who believes in the possibility, or at least the desirability, of being able to talk across differences. And that's the context in which I also make the claim about how maybe Westerners, when I'm critiquing them, need to see difference itself slightly differently, not as threatening and as wild. And I would make exactly the same argument to Muslims as well. And the history of Muslim civilization at its best was a history of actually not harmony or compatibility, not even tolerance, because that strikes me as a somewhat negative word, but accommodation, engagement, conversation, dialogue, learning, and sharing.
What do you think of Muslim civilization today as it exists in 47 Muslim-majority countries?
I think it's very hostile to women, and I think it's close-minded in a way that it was not at an earlier period in time. I think that the way in which politics and the politics of colonialism, the residues of that politics in many societies, the extremism, the fanaticism, these are all things that bother me, disturb me, and which motivate me to raise my voice against them as well.
Asma Barlas, thank you for raising your voice here on The Spirit of Things.
Thank you very much for allowing me to do so.
Asma Barlas was in Australia as a guest of the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. She's professor of politics at Ithaca College and has also written on religion. Her book, Believing Women in Islam, Unreading Patriarchal Interpretations of the Quran, was published in 2002. Details are on our website, as well as links, and later in the week, a transcript. Just go to abc.net.au/radionational and look for The Spirit of Things. Production this week was by me and Jeff Wood, with sound engineering by Michelle Goldsworthy. Next week, it's the creaky doors, thumps in the night, and those strange things you find hidden in the wall space when you renovate. Just what's going on? Find out from the experts on haunted houses next week. And we really do get down to material evidence, no kidding. I'm Rachel Kahn. Join me next week on The Spirit of Things, right here on RN.